Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says imposing sanctions on nations is a new form of domination, and it requires the cooperation of independent states to counter such measures. The senior British Conservative lawmaker accuses the government of intimidation and blackmail of lawmakers over their opposition to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Plus, a German probe finds that former Pope Benedict XVI failed to act over 4 cases of child sex abuse as Archbishop of Munich. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian president slammed sanctions as a new form of domination, calling for a collective response from independent nations to counter such measures.
Sanctioning nations is a common form of new domination, and countering it requires cooperation of sovereign states and a collective response. Otherwise, sanctions will affect all countries, even U.S. allies, under various pretexts.
Ebrahim Raisi denounced sanctions as part of a broader agenda to undermine sovereign states. The Iranian president noted that independent nations are experiencing a historic growth in power, while the U.S. is suffering its weakest position. In reference to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, Raisi said Tehran is serious about reaching an agreement only if the other signatories are serious about removing sanctions in an effective and practical manner.
We are not satisfied with anything less than our rights. The Islamic Republic of Iran is serious about reaching an agreement if the other parties are serious about removing the sanctions effectively and operationally.
Raisi reiterated that based on a decree from the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, nuclear weapons have no place in the country's military doctrine. He made the remarks in an address to the lower house of the Russian parliament on the second and final day of his official visit to Moscow. Raisi said that Iran is seeking maximum interaction with all countries around the world, especially its neighbors and allies. He once again called for further expansion of ties between Tehran and Moscow. This, he said, can help prevent the presence of third parties in the region and help sustain regional peace and stability. The U.S. Secretary of State says talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA are at an urgent point.
And we are indeed at a decisive moment. We can bring these talks to a successful conclusion and address the core concerns of all sides, but time is running out. If a deal is not reached in the coming weeks, Iran's ongoing nuclear advances, which resumed after we withdrew from the agreement, will make it impossible for us to return to the JCPOA.
Antony Blinken said reviving the deal is still possible despite modest progress. He repeated Washington's threat to resort to a different course of action if negotiations fail to yield a breakthrough. Blinken made the remarks in a joint conference with the German foreign minister in Berlin. Annalena Baerbock also said urgent progress is needed in the Vienna talks. This comes as the 8th round of talks is underway between Iran and the P4+1 group. The U.S. is not directly involved in the talks since it unilaterally pulled out of the agreement in 2018, reimposing sanctions on Iran. Tehran says that it will return to compliance only after verifiable removal of those sanctions. We were earlier joined by our Vienna correspondent Homolesky, who gave us the latest on the ongoing talks between Iran and the other JCPOA signatories. She noted that Iranian sources say that the other side's attempt to push a deadline could be a strategy to force Tehran into giving more concessions.
Still continuing with this 8th round of the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And the Iranian team led by Mr. Barghari today had yet another meeting with the EU coordinator, Enrique Mora. Yesterday, there was a trilateral meeting between Iran, Russia and China, the sides whose positions are closer together. We are hearing from Western diplomats, both U.S. sources and unnamed European diplomats, of gaps or differences still remaining. So Iran says that first, the sanctions need to be removed verifiably. After it's verified, it will go back to its commitments. This is also something that's being discussed at the moment. As to the prospects of the talks, are we nearing an agreement? The Americans, the Europeans say they don't want this to drag on. It looks like there is this pressure coming from them that if this doesn't happen within the next weeks, maybe by the end of January, by the early February, then this is not going to work. The Iranian sources say that this could be part of a strategy to put pressure on the Iranians around the negotiating table to get more concessions. They're saying that they're not abiding by any deadline, and what's important, they say, for the Iranian team is to get a good agreement, one that can be trusted on, relied upon, and one that can be sustainable for the foreseeable future.
Iran, China, and Russia will conduct a massive naval drill on Friday north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day drill will engage the latest vessels of the three countries, the aim of boosting coordination and synergy between their navies. Press CBC's Yusuf Jalali has more from the location of the drill.
Russian and Chinese naval vessels arrived in Iran's southern waters after sailing thousands of kilometers to take part in a joint drill with Iran's naval forces. Codenamed the Maritime Security Belt, the one-day drill will be conducted on Friday over a 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean.
The Maritime Security Belt Maneuvers 2022 will be conducted with the participation of 11 vessels from the Iranian Army's Navy, 3 vessels from the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, 3 vessels from the Russian Federation, and 3 vessels from the People's Republic of China.
We came here to conduct a successful drill. I hope that we'll achieve our set goals as we have done in previous drills with Iran.
Russia's Pacific Fleet has deployed a flotilla comprising its guided missile cruiser, Varyag, and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tribute. China has also sent its Urumqi destroyer. This as Iran has used its latest domestically built destroyers, Dina and Jamaran, as well as its guided missile vessel, Tabarzin.
Given the common interests of most countries in north of the Indian Ocean, our joint drills seek to enhance coordination and synergy between the three navies, to holster the security of maritime trade and combat piracy and marine terrorism.
China, Russia, and Iran's naval cooperation is an all-win measure that ensures the safety of international shipping. Most of Russia's international trade is carried out through maritime shipment. Iran also relies on shipping for its oil exports. China's imports of oil and gas and some other foreign trade depend on sea transit as well. So the trilateral drill is seen as an important step towards safeguarding the economic security for the three countries. It's the third time Iran is holding a joint naval exercise with Russia and China. Officials say the trilateral drill is not aimed at any specific country and seeks to encourage all actors in the region to join hands for a collective security in regional waters. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian port city of Chabahar.
Let's talk about this with Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, who joins us from Leesburg, Virginia. Mike Billington, welcome. When you take a look at the three, China, Iran, and Russia, to conduct these naval drills, tell us why that is significant, not only within itself, but coming at this juncture.
Okay, I can barely hear you, but I did hear you. See if you can make it louder. This is not only a strategic issue. The economic agreement that is now being worked out between Iran and China is this $25 billion economic deal is exemplary of the absolutely urgent transformation of the world as a whole to one of development rather than the geopolitical showdown that's going down between the United States and Russia and China. We have not only Iran working openly with Russia and China for economic development, not just for strategic strength. We also have in Iraq our friend Hussein Askari, whom I'm sure you know, who you've interviewed many times, is actively engaged with thousands of Iraqis promoting going back to the deal that was struck between the former President Mahdi with China for economic development, oil for development. You have Argentine's President Fernandez, who is traveling to Russia before he then travels to China for the Olympics, but of course not just talking about the Olympics, but meeting with Xi Jinping and also discussing major economic development projects. And of course, Mr. Putin is also going to Beijing to meet with Xi Jinping around the time of the opening of the Olympics. So this is a major move towards establishing a counter to the generally bankrupt IMF, World Bank financial structure in Europe and the United States, which is going through the threat of a hyperinflation, a general breakdown of energy resources, a quadrupling of the cost of natural gas, and of course the geopolitics, which is driving the threat of an actual war between the U.S. and Russia, just like in Taiwan, the potential of a war with China, both of which would be insane, and can and must be reversed by focusing on the idea that the United States must break from this geopolitics and must work with Russia and China on a new paradigm for the world financial system. What's coming into play between Russia and China and the Belt and Road countries, 140 nations, and now these very dramatic steps towards bringing development into the Middle East and Iraq and Iran and elsewhere, this cannot be seen as an alternative to the so-called Western financial system. We have to bring about a new Bretton Woods approach, a new global financial system, which stops, basically puts the Western financial system through bankruptcy, so that the massive speculative paper, useless, worthless gambling debts that are now dominating the Western financial system can be put through bankruptcy, that we can restore a sane banking system in the West and bring the United States industries and the very powerful science and technology capacities of the United States to bear in building the world rather than shutting it down. So I emphasize that the strategic side of Iran collaborating with Russia and China is important, but it's important primarily because we are moving towards a new paradigm of economic development, infrastructure, the kind of development of industry and science and technology, which is the urgent antidote to the global financial and strategic crisis that the world is facing today.
Sure. I'm wondering if there's going to be a reaction coming from, in particular, the U.S. on this exercise that's going to take place, and also whether this forms now an alliance in which each country, namely Iran, Russia, and China, will come to the defense of the other were it to be threatened by, let's say, the U.S.
Well, again, that's true, of course. But I would look at the connection between the strategic situation and the economic crisis. What's driving the war is not geopolitics. We don't like Iran. We don't like Russia. We don't like China. That's not what's driving this danger of a war. What's driving it is the financial breakdown crisis in the Western financial system. And we have to look in terms of how to bring the United States out of this geopolitics view of the world, us against them, zero sum, and so forth, and to recognize that it's the original American system that looked at the world in a win-win manner. Of course, my organization, Mr. LaRouche's organization, has always argued that we must bring the U.S. back to the American system, which we really last saw with Franklin Roosevelt and Kennedy. But we have to do it urgently. We have to do it in the context of focusing on why the world is turning to Russia and China and the Belt and Road as a development policy rather than the kind of a almost colonial policy that's been seen coming out of the U.S. and the British with these wars in the Middle East and the idea of sanctions and military confrontation around the world. It's a moment of great crisis, but that crisis represents an opportunity. It's a moment in which people in the U.S., even in the administration, are beginning to wake up to the fact that they are no longer the only superpower, that they're not the only game in town, that this is a moment where they have to come to terms with the fact that the U.S. development itself, my country's development and survival, depends on working with especially Russia and China and the rest of the world and ending these geopolitical confrontations in favor of peace through development.
Thank you for that. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review. Moving on, the Yemeni army releases footage of recent operations against UAE-led mercenaries and Daesh terrorists in the country's Shabwa province. The Ansarullah movement says that the strikes killed and injured a large number of foreign-backed militants. Separately, the Yemeni army launched retaliatory drone attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates on Monday. According to UAE officials, the attacks targeted Abu Dhabi International Airport, as well as storage facilities of a state-owned oil company. The United Arab Emirates has been supporting ex-regime loyalists in southern Yemen. The militants have been trying to make advances towards the Harib and Ain districts in Marib province. Scandal continues to haunt the UK's embattled Prime Minister. A senior lawmaker from Boris Johnson's Conservative Party now accuses him of blackmail.
In recent days, a number of members of Parliament have faced pressures and intimidation from members of the government because of their declared or assumed desire for a vote of confidence in the party leadership of the Prime Minister. The intimidation of a member of Parliament is a serious matter. Moreover, the reports of which I'm aware would seem to constitute blackmail.
William Rack, who chairs the Committee on Constitutional Issues, advised his colleagues to report the matter to police. The Prime Minister's office says that there is no evidence to support Rack's claim. Johnson is under pressure from within and outside of his party for a number of scandals, including breach of COVID-19 rules by hosting a party at Downing Street in late 2020. Some Conservative lawmakers have already declared their support for challenging Johnson's leadership. The process would require 54 letters in support of a no-confidence vote. The Prime Minister is defying calls to resign. The report accuses former Pope Benedict XVI of failing to take action on 4 cases of sexual abuse in his archdiocese when he was Archbishop of Munich. The report commissioned by the archdiocese counts nearly 500 victims of abuse, mainly young males. The lawyers, however, say many other cases probably passed unreported. Pope Benedict has previously denied wrongdoing over the cases, adding fuel to a scandal that has long engulfed the Catholic Church. The report also found fault with the current Archbishop of Munich in 2 suspected cases. In 2018, Germany's Catholic Church apologized to victims after a report found that clerics had abused around 3,700 victims in the 7 decades up to 2014. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party in the United States, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Lisa Lehrer and Astrid Herndon. The piece is titled, Menace Enters the Republican Mainstream. Threats of violence have become commonplace among a significant part of the Republican Party, as historians and those who study democracy warn of a dark shift in American politics. At a conservative rally in western Idaho last month, a young man stepped up to a microphone to ask when he could start killing Democrats. "When do we get to use the guns?" he said, as the audience applauded. "How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?" The local state representative, a Republican, later called it a fair question. In Ohio, the leading candidate in the Republican primary for Senate blasted out a video urging Republicans to resist the tyranny of a federal government that pushed them to wear face masks and take FDA-authorized vaccines. "When the Gestapo show up at your front door," the candidate, Josh Mandel, a grandson of a Holocaust survivor, said in the video in September, "you know what to do." And in Congress, violent threats against lawmakers are on track to double this year. Republicans who break party ranks and defy former President Donald J. Trump have come to expect insults, invective, and even death threats, often stoked by their own colleagues and conservative activists who have denounced them as traitors. From congressional offices to community meeting rooms, threats of violence are becoming commonplace among a significant segment of the Republican Party. 10 months after rioters attacked the United States Capitol on 6th of January, and after 4 years of a president who often spoke in violent terms about his adversaries, right-wing Republicans are talking more openly and frequently about the use of force, as justifiable in opposition to those who dislodge them from power. In Washington, where decorum and civility are still given lip service, violent or threatening language still remains uncommon, if not unheard of, among lawmakers who spend a great deal of time in the same building. But among the most fervent conservatives who play an outsized role in primary contests and provide the Republican Party with its activist energy, the belief that the country is at a crossroads that could require armed confrontation is no longer limited to the fringe. Political violence has been part of the American story since the founding of the country, often entwined with racial politics and erupting in periods of great change. More than 70 brawls, duels, and other violent incidents embroiled members of Congress from 1830 to 1860 alone, and elements of the left have contributed to the confrontational tenor of the country's current politics, though Democratic leaders routinely condemn violence and violent imagery. But historians and those who study democracy say what has changed has been the embrace of violent speech by a sizable proportion of one party, including some of its loudest voices inside government and most influential voices outside of government. In effect, they warn the Republican Party is mainstreaming menace as a political tool. Omar Russell, a political scientist at Pomona College who studies protests and race, drew a contrast between the current climate and earlier periods of turbulence and strife, like the 1960s or the run-up to the Civil War. What's different about almost all those other events is that now there's a partisan divide around the legitimacy of our political system, he said. The elite endorsement of political violence from factions of the Republican Party is distinct for me from what we saw in the 1960s. Then you didn't have, from a president on down, politicians calling citizens to engage in violent resistance. From his earliest campaigning to the final moments of his presidency, Donald Trump's political image has incorporated the possibility of violence. Trump encouraged attendees at his rallies to knock the hell out of protesters, praised the lawmaker who body slammed a reporter, and in a recent interview defended rioters who clamored to hang Mike Pence. Yet, even with the former president largely out of the public eye, and after a deadly attack on the Capitol where rioters tried to overturn the presidential election, the Republican acceptance of violence has only spread. Opinion polls indicate that 30% of Republicans and 40% of people who most trust far-right news sources believe that true patriots may have to resort to violence to save the country, a statement that gets far less support among Democrats and among independents. Such views, routinely expressed in warlike or revolutionary terms, are often intertwined with white racial resentments and evangelical Christian religious fervor, two potent sources of fuel for the GOP during the Trump era. as the most animated Republican voters increasingly see themselves as participants in a struggle, if not a kind of holy war, to preserve their idea of American culture and their place in society. Notably, few Republican leaders have spoken out against violent language or violent behavior since 6th of January this year, suggesting with their silent acquiescence that doing so would put them at odds with a significant share of their party's voters. When the Idaho man asked about killing political opponents at an event hosted by the conservative activist Charlie Kirk, Mr. Kirk said he must denounce the question, but went on to discuss at what point political violence could be justified. In that vacuum, the coarsening of Republican messaging has continued. Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, this week tweeted an anime video altered to show him killing Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and swinging two swords at Joe Biden. Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at the left-leaning group New America who has studied political violence, said there was a connection between such actions and the growing view among Americans that politics is a struggle between enemies. When you start dehumanizing political opponents, or really anybody, it becomes a lot easier to inflict violence on them, Dr. Drutman said. I have a hard time seeing how we have a peaceful 2024 election after everything that's happened now, he said. I don't see the rhetoric turning down. I don't see the conflict going away. I really do think it's hard to see how it gets better before it gets worse. Democrats are seeking Paul Gosar's censure, arguing that depictions of violence can foment actual violence and jeopardize the safety of elected officials. The ranking GOP lawmakers, Senator Mitch McConnell and Representative Kevin McCarthy, did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Kevin McCarthy, who initially condemned the 6th of January attack on the Capitol and said violence is never a legitimate form of protest, more recently has joked about hitting Nancy Pelosi in the head with a gavel if he were to replace her as Speaker of the House. Like nearly all of the members of his caucus, Kevin McCarthy has said nothing about Paul Gosar's video. For his part, Representative Paul Gosar, Republican of Arizona, has suggested that critics were overly thin-skinned, insisting that the video was an allegory of a debate over immigration policy. He was slaying the policy monster of open borders, not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Joe Biden, his office said. It is a symbolic cartoon. It is not real life. Carlos Curbelo, a Republican former congressman from Florida who is a critic of Donald Trump, said Republicans needed to take a stronger approach against violent language and intimidation tactics. I do think the problem is more acute among Republicans because there are a handful of Republican officials who have no limits, he said. Your country and your integrity should be more important to you than your re-election. The increasing violence of Republican speech has been accompanied by a willingness of GOP leaders to follow Donald Trump's lead and shrug off allegations of domestic violence that once would have been considered disqualifying for political candidates in either political party. Herschel Walker, the former professional football player running for Senate in Georgia, is accused of repeatedly threatening his former wife's life. But one Donald Trump's endorsement and appears to be consolidating party support behind his candidacy. Donald Trump also backed the Ohio congressional campaign of Max Miller, who faces allegations of violence from his former girlfriend, the former White House press secretary Stephanie Grisham. Max Miller has sued Stephanie Grisham for defamation. And Sean Parnell, a Senate candidate in Pennsylvania who was endorsed by Donald Trump, appeared in court this week in a custody fight in which his estranged wife accuses him of choking her and physically harming their children. Sean Parnell denies the charges.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
Verse 49 of Surah Al-Qamar, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Inna kulla shay'in khalaqnahu biqadar. We, everything, created it biqadar, with a certain taqdeer, with a certain portion, a measurement, a certain time. Everything has been created. We, God says, we created everything in this way. And it emphasizes we, it starts with that inna, then it emphasizes everything. Kulla shay'in khalaqnahu, again, we created it. Biqadar, in this way, biqadar, with taqdeer. Everything has a measurement, a time. Before that time, it will not happen. After that time, it will not happen. It will happen exactly on that time. At that time, not before or after. But this should not cause you to think God does things at a different time. His doing, His action, the attribution of things happening to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not timed. We are within the context of time. When we do things, the action, the deed, the verb, whatever it is that we're doing, the creation, if we create in our material sense, if we make a car, if we make a house, if we do whatever we do it within the context of time. We don't do it before or after. We, as the subject of the verb, the one who does that, who performs that act, are within the context of time. Within the limitations of time, within the limitations and the restrictions and the restraints of time, our existence is timed. We are part of what God has created. And that qadar, that includes time, we are part of that. Our existence is time. We came into existence at a certain time. We will leave this material realm at a certain time. Everything is time. So when we do something, the action, the deed, is timed. We are also timed. We should not think the same is true regarding Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah says we created everything with a qadar. Everything that is created has got time. There was a time where this earth existed. There were no human beings. There was a certain time that the human beings were put on earth. Before that, they weren't. After this is done, they won't be. It's only when God wants. There's a certain time. Everything is time, but is the subject of this verb, the one who creates this, the one who has done this, who has made this, is he restrained by time? Is he doing this? And if does he decide to do this once now? He decides that we create man, and then time goes by with him, and then after a while he decides. This verse explains, verse 50, that that's not the case. وَمَا أَمْرُنَا إِلَّا وَاحِدَةٌ كَلَمْحٍ بِالْبَصَرِ. It's difficult for us to explain, to understand. God uses an example. He says, our amr, our command in all of this happening, in everything happening, the whole thing, with all of the taqdeerat, our amr is wahida, it's one. Kun, other verses have kun fayakun. Wants it and it happens. Everything with the taqdeer. He wants it to happen this at this time, that at that time, first this, then that. The whole thing, right? But the attribution to him, is it him doing one thing first, then the next thing? The way we do it, we plan things. So I decide that this year I'm going to do this, next year I'm going to do this. I haven't done it. I've decided to do it. I put a time on it. When do I do it? When the time arrives. I plan for Saturday night that I'm going to give this speech. Next Saturday I have a different plan. Did I do next Saturday's right now? No, I just maybe sketched something in the calendar. I will. When will I do it? The attribution of the action is when? When I do it. I actually do that. He says no. The whole thing in now كل شيء خلقناه بقدر. Everything has a taqdeer in it. But God willing it in its entirety, with all those time restraints and everything, wahida. And that, in terms of, if you want to think in the context of time, it's not in the context of time, but since we are so bound by time and we can only think, he says, like kalamhim bil basar, it's like a blink of an eye. The whole creation, from those millions of these millions of years, according to the calculations that scientists have done in terms of the age of the Earth, with, you know, however accurate that is, I don't know when we're going to find and hear a scientist question and doubt how much of that is true. We don't know. At least I don't know. They have said this, we've read it, but how accurate that is, it's not divine. So many times they thought something was definitely the case, then they came back and said, no, that's not the case. But we don't know. Based on what they have said, it seems somewhere in the hundreds of thousands, millions, or whatever number of years, all of this, and God knows how much longer in this material realm, and then the change of it, and exactly what that means, and resurrection, and what khulud means in that case, this whole thing, أمرنا وما أمرنا إلا واحدة كلمحٍ بالبصر. It's important to know this. Don't, in your mind, think of even God's action, not Him. We are told in regards to Him that when we try to understand, one of the terms that we have, one of the adhkar that we have, is Allahu Akbar. Okay, and we have been, it's been explained to us through hadith that Allahu Akbar means Allahu Akbar an yusaf. He is greater than to be described. Any type of description regarding anything, all of what we understand as attribution or attributes or sifat or asma, okay, all of these, none of these are Him. They are attributes. He is akbaru an yusaf. He is greater greater than to be described in any way. This is found in the first khutbah of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi. A very difficult khutbah to understand. Anyhow, it's important, this verse tells us that even when we're thinking of His deeds, what in our limited understanding we can call His actions, His will, His amr, His command, it's important that we understand that we can't fully understand it. To know it's one, in other words, there's no multiplicity in it, even in His will. Amruna, not Him, His will. Amruna, His command. Even in His command, there's no multiplicity. It's singular. And the closest thing you can think of is kalamhim bil basar. It's one instance. And when it's done, then the whole thing is there with all the time that is in it, is within the context of it. It's within this creation. The time of everything is within it in the various ways that the verses of the Quran tell us. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put that time within this, and how things happen one after the other, and who's responsible for what part of it, and so on and so forth. Then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَقَدْ أَهْلَكْنَا أَشْيَاعَهُمْ فَهَلْ مِنْ مُدَّكِرٍ. We destroyed أَشْيَاعَهُمْ, apparently it means either, well, the word Shia a lot of times, and this is a derivative of that, could be the plural of it. I haven't done thorough reading of Tafasir. What comes to mind based on my limited knowledge here is their likes, their the people that are like them. We have these people that are now standing and they think they're all that, and standing up to God's guidance, to His Prophet, and so on and so forth. We have destroyed already the likes of them, or people who follow the same thing. فَهَلْ مِن مُدَّكِرٍ. Is there anyone to be reminded? وَكُلُّ شَيْءٍ فَعَلُوهُ فِي الزُّبُرِ. And everything they have done is in Zubur. They're in books. وَكُلُّ صَغِيرٍ وَكَبِيرٍ مُسْتَطَرٍ. Every small and big or great deed, everything, the smallest, most minute thing that is done, and the greatest thing that is done, the insignificance of an act, or the greatness of it, none of them are reasons for it not being recorded. Everything is recorded. Mustatar means it's written in lines, or in other words, transcribed. It's written. Everything is recorded. The last verses here, إِنَّ الْمُتَّقِينَ فِي جَنَّاتٍ وَنَهَرٍ. The muttaqin are in gardens and streams. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ. In a maq'ad is similar to manzil. It's where you sit. Okay, maq'ad sidq, your sitting place, the place you do qu'ud in, you sit, is, in other words, your station. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ. The position, station, sitting place of Sidq, truth. عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. By a malik, a sovereign, that is muqtadir, that is mighty.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم الحال حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. The United Nations organization is supposed to be strictly neutral and to spare no efforts in brokering peace between or among its member states without taking sides with any party. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kehan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading UN Policies Expand Theater of Yemen War into UAE. Stay tuned for more. The United Nations organization is supposed to be strictly neutral and to spare no efforts in brokering peace between or among its member states without taking sides with any party. This appears fine on paper, especially on the UN Charter, but in practice, the so-called world body has long deviated from its goals and allowed itself to be used as a tool for serving the vested interests of some of its founding members, especially the U.S. We in Iran suffered this stepmotherly treatment during the eight-year war the United States had imposed upon us in 1980s through Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad. Neither the bloodthirsty dictator's frequent attacks on ships, railways, buses, and planes were condemned, nor his targeting of city centers and use of chemical weapons, let alone the denunciation of the U.S. for its role in openly siding with Saddam in the war imposed upon the Islamic Republic. This same negative attitude of the U.N. towards the oppressed Palestinian people over the past 74 years is now fully evident in Yemen, where for the past 7 years, the Arab world's most impoverished country is subjected to the US-backed Saudi-UAE invasion that has destroyed the infrastructure and killed almost 400,000 men, women, and children. The UN, instead of naming the aggressors and demanding end of aggression, calls Yemen's defenders rebels for protecting their homeland and has banned any supply of weapons to them, while turning a blind eye to the massive flow of lethal American, British, and French armaments to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to continue more crimes against humanity. The other day, it urged Yemen's government in Sana'a to release a UAE ship, which had been impounded for carrying sophisticated weapons to the mercenaries prolonging the war. The Yemeni government has rightfully rejected the release of Raubi, which was carrying military equipment, and charged the UN of siding with murderers who violate international law. Sana'a also deplored the hypocrisy of the world body for its refusal to criticize the continued bombing of Yemeni towns and cities by the Saudi Air Force and the active involvement of the UAE to fuel the flames of war in Shabwa, Ma'arib, and other regions. After due warnings to the UAE to desist from its destabilizing role in Yemen, the popular Ansarullah movements had no other choice but to retaliate by targeting industrial and military sites in Abu Dhabi while destroying a UAE military transport plane in Shabwa in central Yemen. This means, because of the dubious policies of the UN, the theater of the seven-year war is expanding and may cause death and destruction on a wide scale in the Persian Gulf region that accounts for 20% of the world's crude oil supplies. The deaths that occurred at Abu Dhabi International Airport and in the Musaffah Industrial Area, where three oil tankers were set ablaze through precision strikes, rests solely on the UN shoulders. If the UAE continues its sedition in Yemen, then it should brace for more such drone or ballistic missile attacks that would trigger a massive exodus back home of foreign workers along with economic collapse, all because of the negative role of the United Nations organization.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
کار رو برای خدا میکرد، تظاهر نداشت، لافزنی نداشت. خدای متعال اولین پاداش دنیایی که به این اخلاص او داد همین تشییع 10 میلیونی بود.
He would work because of God and he was free of pretentious behavior and boasting. The first worldly reward that God the exalted bestowed on him for his sincerity after his being killed was his burial ceremony in which tens of millions of people participated. That burial ceremony was his first worldly reward for his sincerity, and of course there is his reward in the hereafter. The popularity of Shahid Soleimani's name, personality and memory was his worldly reward. After the past 2 years, Marta Soleimani's name has been repeated and written by various individuals thousands and thousands of times. This year too, people themselves have organized commemoration ceremonies for him. But as I said, I will get to this topic. These are due to the sincerity of that dear Shaheed.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
شهید سلیمانی الگو شد. یکی از حقایق بسیار برجسته اینه که شهید سلیمانی تبدیل شد به یک الگو.
شهید سلیمانی became a role model. An outstanding reality is that Shaheed Soleimani has become a role model. Today, many of the youth in the Islamic world, and particularly in the region, the information that I have is related to the region, are thirsty for the emergence of heroes such as Shaheed Soleimani. They are thirsty for such heroes. The more the memory of Shaheed Soleimani is promoted, the thirstier and more enthusiastic they become for the presence of such heroes in their own countries. In our region today, Marta Soleimani is a symbol of hope, self-confidence and courage. He is the secret to resistance and victory. These things are in the hands of God, not in the hands of anyone else. The likes of people such as us cannot accomplish such things, no matter what strategy we use. Such things are done by God Himself.
جریان ضد استکباری در منطقه، جریان مقاومت در منطقه امروز از دو سال پیش پر رونق‌تر و شادابتر و امیدوارتر داره حرکت میکنه و کار میکنه.
The anti-arrogance movement and the resistance movement in the region are moving forward in a stronger, more dynamic and more hopeful way than 2 years ago. In Syria, the enemies are faced with a dead end. The enemies in Syria have no hope for the future. These are blessings from that dear innocent blood.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.